Hello everyone, and welcome to The History of England, episode 168, with horns and trumpets. Before I start, I mentioned to you all that I joined a group of like-minded podcasters, and we call ourselves Agora. Well, we thought every month we'd highlight one of the podcasts in the network to all our listeners, and this month it's Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy. Some of you will already know the podcast since Steve did a guest episode some time ago, number 99, I think. Well, now Steve's reached the 5th century, so why not hop along to his website, Atos History Page with a Z.com, or to iTunes, or indeed I've put a link on my website to boot. Last time, which was some time ago now, we left the Yorkists riding furiously down muddy lanes to escape Lancastrian clutches, to flee to Ireland and to Calais and preserve the hopes of the Yorkist party. In the next three episodes, we have the most dramatic period of all, at least militarily, for the whole Wars of the Roses, with ups and downs you would scornfully laugh at if it was in a novel. Ha ha ha! But what you're about to hear, gentle and indeed noble listeners, is nothing but the truth. Not necessarily the whole truth, otherwise we'd be here all year, but nothing but the truth for sure. Or at least the truth as far as I can know it. Anyway, onward. Edward, Earl of March, Salisbury and Warwick rode hard all the way down to Devon, where they rocked up at the house of Joanna Dinham. On the face of it, this was a strange choice. Joanna's late husband, John Dinham, had been a pretty fervent royalist. His father had been a violent and colourful man, if you can bear a brief digression. So his great-grandfather had been killed by two so-called notorious thieves. And so at the age of 24, John Dinham III had found and slaughtered one of them, chased the other to Exeter Cathedral, where he'd slaughtered him, to the horror of all right-minded folks concerned with the sacrilege of God's house. Never mind, he'd got himself a king's pardon for that, only to commit acts of violence again in 1402 and 1404, significant enough to reach the ears of the king's justices. But then he'd become a courtier, with a love of the high life and luxury, binding his hunting arrows with gold. Anyway, John Dinham IV had been a supporter of the king all his life, until he died in 1458, but clearly Warwick or Salisbury knew something the king didn't, because when they rocked up at Nutwell House, they were welcomed by Joanna Dinham. Her son, rather unimaginatively named John, rushed out and found a Ballinger, a small seagoing boat, and bought it for £40, which, it has to be said, sounds like a princely sum at the time. So someone caught wind of a sense of desperation in his voice during the negotiation. And from there, Dinham and his VIPs sailed to Guernsey, and finally to Calais and safety. Queen Margaret, meanwhile, visited her revenge on the Yorkists at a parliament almost immediately following the rout of Ludford Bridge, held at Coventry. In fact, the Parliament was reasonably well attended by Lords. 67 of a possible 97 were there. I'd repeat my point of last time that we have to make a clear distinction between the King before and after his mental breakdown in 1453, and understand that after 1453 he drifted in and out of capability. So by and large, we have to assume that Margaret was still driving the bus at this point. The Parliament at which the Queen took her revenge and sought to assure a future for her and Somerset's, I mean Henry's son, became known as the Parliament of Devils. It became known as such because the purpose of the Parliament was to consign the Yorkists to the graveyard of history, to pass a bill of attainder. Attainder was the legal death of the Neville and Plantagenet family. All their rights and lands taken away from them and their heirs. From men of almost godlike power to nobodies, condemned to scratch around in the dirt for their living, begging door to door and living on whatever charity they could find. The whole Parliament was part of the Lancastrian propaganda, their best chance to tell the story as they would like to have it known. Margaret poured all her fury, bile, scorn, and relief into the Bill of Attainder. Basically, it painted a story of the evil York and his allies and the crimes and treacheries they had committed against this king, time and time again. It was said that Salisbury, York, Warwick, Edward of March, quote, falsely and traitorously conspired and sought the time and means of the accomplishment of their insatiable will and desire of the destruction of you, Sovereign Lord, the Queen, our Sovereign Lady, and your succession. The bill demanded that, for the said traitorous levying of war against your said most noble person, that they be declared attainted of high treason as false traitors and enemy against your most noble person, High Majesty, Crown, and Dignity. And I have to say that from the Queen's point of view, while in a rather one-eyed kind of way it ignored the fact that Henry had proved incapable, you can see that you might read the facts in that way. Rather less credibly, the bill presented Henry not only as a generous sovereign whose trust had been betrayed, but also a vigorous soldier who had valiantly faced down his enemies on the field of battle, whose words were, quote, so witty, so knightly, so manly. Okay. I have no idea how many lords in the Parliament felt all of this was a little unfair, but none of them were going to squeak even so much as a mouse. The Queen was in her pomp, and a vindictive one at that. Friends who had been friends and supporters of York were condemned to lose their name and wealth as well. Devereux, Oldhall. And most unfairly, John de la Pole, the new Duke of Suffolk, was demoted to Earl simply for having married York's daughter Elizabeth. The Stanleys unbelievably got away with their lack of enthusiasm at Bloor Heath. Just to abandon any pretense of objective history just for one moment, world out there, if there is one player in the Wars of the Roses I despised more than any other as a 12-year-old, it was the Stanleys. Now, having been worn down by the practicality and compromises inherent in 27 years of making a living, I can probably at least understand the Stanleys now, but if I ever accept the Stanleys as any kind of role model, then that 12-year-old inside of me will have forever and finally died. Just so you know. It's also probably worth mentioning the noble and haughty Cecily Neville, left with her children at Ludlow, presumably, I hope, after some discussion with her husband. Well, Cecily took herself to Coventry and threw herself at the feet of the king. While Big Shot Richard was living in noble revolt in Ireland, Cecily just had to get on with the daily grind of survival. Margaret was, however, kinder to Cecily. She'd always liked Cecily. She remembered Cecily's efforts when she'd learned that she, Margaret, was pregnant. So although York and his entire family had been stripped of everything, Cecily was given 1,000 marks a year to live on. Having said that, she still had to go and live with her sister Anne, who was the Duchess of Buckingham. By all accounts, Anne and her hub made Cecily's life a misery, a daily procession of tongue-lashings and condescensions. Cecily and the brood with her, Margaret, George, Richard, kept their heads down, towed the line, waited and hoped for better times. Irritatingly for Margaret, the principal objects of her hatred had escaped the net. So, Margaret both rewarded her followers and gave them the resources they needed to pursue her enemies right to their lairs. Owen Tudor was given a pension. His son Jasper Tudor was to be the instrument of Yorkist destruction in Wales. He was given York's vast estates there and was to winkle out and destroy York's remaining sympathisers. Meanwhile, young 23-year-old Henry Beaufort recovered from his wounds at St Albans in 1455, burning with hatred and desire for revenge against Warwick, was appointed Captain of Calais, a claim he'd have to make good by removing Warwick. And remarkably, James Butler, the Earl of Wiltshire, who had consistently proved himself the most feeble and cowardly of men, was made Lord Lieutenant of Ireland and given the task of taking the job away from Richard of York. Good luck with that. Wiltshire never got close to taking the war to York anywhere that would put himself in danger. Instead, what he did was to team up with Exeter to do a bit of harrying and hanging of York's tenants in the Newbury area, where the worst threat he'd face would be the odd dirty look or run-in with a cowpat. But not so Henry Beaufort, the young Duke of Somerset. To give that lad his due, he was up for it. He beat a path first of all to Andrew Trollope, the defector from Calais, and indentured his men of Calais. Good fighting men, good knowledge of Calais. Following the same theme, he teamed up with the Woodville family. Richard Woodville, Lord Rivers, had been deputy at Calais and would also be a useful ally. Plus, Somerset might have heard that Rivers' 22-year-old daughter Elizabeth was an absolute knockout, even if she was married to some loser called Grey of Groby. So Rivers and his son Anthony Woodville set up shop at Sandwich on the southeast coast to get an army of 1,000 men together, while Somerset and Trollope launched their first attack on Calais. As it happens, all they saw of Calais were the backsides of the men guarding the wall, but Somerset did land at the nearby castle of Guisnes. Trollope arranged a deal with the garrison, and they were in business, launching raids across the Pale of Calais from their new base of Guisnes Castle. Now, the normal run of us would be somewhat downcast by all this defeat and despair. You would be forgiven for supposing that York, Salisbury, Warwick and the young Earl of March would hide away and try to keep themselves safe. And if you did so suppose, and if indeed York and Salisbury and March were downcast, then they'd not figured with Warwick. Now, obviously, I don't want to go overboard, but it is notable that the bloke that gets talked about during this period most is Warwick, not Richard of York. It's Warwick that pulls the Yorkist buttock away from the boot of defeat. Somerset's first attempt to take Calais with his first fleet was partly thwarted by the relationship Warwick already had with the men of Kent. So after Somerset had landed at Guisnes, the seaman casually allowed his fleet on its return journey to float into the harbour at Calais, pleading unfortunate winds and tides, where Warwick was therefore able to capture them. Oops. Warwick grandly welcomed the men on board to the fight, though executing every single one of Trollope's men that had remained on the ships. But then, in the finest tradition of derring do and chivalry, York is said to have sent a note to Somerset at Guisnes thanking him for the supplies that he'd found in his captured ships. Warwick ran Lancaster ragged during the first half of 1460. Somerset's attempts to attack and capture Calais from Guisnes were batted aside as no more than mildly irritating. Somerset courted the King of France with some success, but Warwick trumped that with the friendship of Duke Philip of Burgundy, who owned the lands around Calais. In fact, it's Warwick's diplomacy with Burgundy that kept Calais safe for so long. The King of France couldn't attack Calais unless Burgundy gave him permission to travel through his lands. Not just that, he actually persuaded Burgundy to supply him with provisions. Meanwhile, the Duke of Exeter had been indentured by the Queen to keep the narrow seas against Warwick, but had instead spent his time raiding York's estates with Wiltshire in Newbury. So his associates, Lord Rivers, and his son, Anthony Woodville, had been set to the task instead. And by January 1460, they were close to being ready to sail with an army to support Somerset and take the war to the Yorkist earls in Calais. But on the morning of January the 15th, a small fleet of ships slipped into the harbour at Sandwich. They'd come from Calais and were led by a man called John Wenlock. Wenlock was a knight who had fought in France and become disillusioned with the conduct of the war under Henry, and in 1459 had been at Ludlow with the Yorkists and had thrown his hand in with them, and as a result had been attainted. I have no idea what Warwick and Wenlock had hoped to achieve with their raid on Sandwich, but the result must have been a success beyond their wildest dreams. The pants of Rivers' army were firmly around their ankles when Wenlock arrived. Before they could get those pants up around their knees, the raiding Yorkists had captured both Rivers from his bed and Anthony Woodville from the town. By the time they were pulling up the hose, all they could see was the Lancastrian fleet leaving the harbour under Wenlock's control. When they finally got to Calais, the poor old Woodvilles were subjected to a fair degree of mockery from Warwick, Salisbury, and the young Edward, Earl of March, being mocked as mere parvenus, before being lobbed into prison for the duration. Now tell me that's not swashbuckling. But there's more swashbuckling to come. Tell me, did Errol Flynn ever do Warwick? If not, he jolly well ought to have done. In March 1460, Warwick sailed to Ireland to confer with the Duke of York and agree how they were going to handle this. Plans and clever tricks were laid down, but on the way back, disaster. There in front of him was a much larger fleet gathered by the evil Exeter. Surely now Warwick was doomed. But no. Warwick leapt onto the bowsprit of his ships, adjusted his tights and ordered the attack. The story goes that Exeter's sailors refused to fight the Golden Earl and the fleet fled for Dartmouth with Warwick's laughter ringing in their ears. And before you could say Errol Flynn, Warwick was back in Calais, sharing hearty slaps on the back and a jolly jape or two. Marvellous. Clearly, the plan was for a descent on England from Calais, led by Warwick, Salisbury and March, while York watched from Ireland. We're not entirely sure why York was taking a back seat in this way, but it could have been that for York to invade from Ireland would A. be risky, and B. not look good, since, as Charles I was to find out a couple of centuries later, the English didn't like the idea of being invaded by foreign soldiers, and it would have done his reputation no good. Across the channel in Sandwich, the Lancastrians were trying again to attack Calais. This time, a chap called Osbert Mountfort was putting together another army to go to the aid of Somerset in Guienne. It turns out this was a bit unfortunate, because it was right where Warwick planned to invade. And so, to order, we get more derring-do. This time it's a man called William Neville, Lord Fauconberg, Warwick's uncle. Fauconberg was an experienced warrior, probably about 60 by now, who'd seen service in France and Scotland again. Fauconberg swooped on Sandwich, surprising Mountfort, and yet another Lancastrian commander was captured and carried away. This one didn't get to join the Woodvilles in prison, though. He was summarily beheaded on the sand below Calais. At last, in June 1460, the invasion fleet sailed. Now, essentially, Yorkist support was strongest in the south and southeast, and in parts of the north where the Nevilles had their power base, while support for the king was strongest in the Midlands and Wales and the north. So, the plan, predictably, was to focus on London before going any further. The propaganda was just the same as before. We love the king, he's a super chap. Our loyalty is unbounded. We're just trying to help. It's those evil councillors. You're used to the format by now. Now it's Wiltshire, Shrewsbury and Beaumont who are the objects of York's fury. Interestingly, targeting Wiltshire was probably a bit of a waste of time, since brave, brave Sir James was actually no longer even in England. James Butler, Earl of Wiltshire, has been a bit of a find for me, I have to say. He's not a name I previously knew anything about. It's one of those instances where it's so frustrating that personality doesn't really come down to us across the centuries, because I want to know why, despite his constant cowardice and desertions, he became so consistently popular at the Queen's side. Anyway, at the time Warwick landed in Kent, Wiltshire had just hired some Genoese ships, stuffed them with his men and his treasure, and had taken them to sea, and by October had taken refuge in Utrecht. Who knows why? But quite possibly, and indeed given his record, quite probably, he was just scared and didn't want anyone to shout at him or hit him. But to be fair, it is also possible that he was in Utrecht to recruit soldiers. Anyway, as Fauconberg and Warwick moved through Kent, men came in their thousands to join the Yorkist banners. Kent remained a grumpy sort of place, the home of Jack Cade's rebellion. And plus, to boot, this was Warwick. This was the bloke that had swashed his buckle up and down the narrow seas. This was the bloke who had put right all this mayhem. By the 2nd of July 1460, Warwick was in front of the impregnable walls of London. which actually proved remarkably pregnable, largely on account of the fact that the mayor welcomed them with open arms, and the Lancastrian garrison fled to the Tower. The following day, in front of cheering, enthusiastic crowds, Warwick, Salisbury, March and Fauconberg all placed their hands on the Cross of Canterbury and swore that they were Henry's liegemen, which was to turn out to be inconvenient. Then, to the massive relief of the mayor, the earl said they couldn't stay, thank you, they'd be on their way, thanks for all the fish. A massive relief, because I don't imagine that entertaining thousands of sweaty young blokes in your house is a lot of fun. However, they did have to suffer a few of them. Salisbury and Wenlock, it was agreed, would stay to besiege the Lancastrians in the Tower. Meanwhile, at the royal court at Coventry, everyone was a flutter. Everything had happened very quickly. An army had to be gathered. The king was, as normal, resting in the nearby abbey, so Buckingham and the queen got him out of there, and as soon as men began to come, Buckingham and the king moved south and east towards the rebels at London, until they came to the town of Northampton on the River Neen. The queen and the little prince stayed at Coventry. So, once at Northampton, Buckingham began to prepare with his commanders, Shrewsbury, Egremont and Edmund Grey of Ruthin. We've heard of the Greys of Ruthin before, which I have relentlessly mispronounced as Ruthin. Stupidly, of course, on account of the fact this is the way it's spelled. However, since my son and I walked there this summer, I have now been put on the straight and narrow. So I will use the correct, though quite clearly potty pronunciation from here on in. Anyway, Buckingham realised he was going to be outnumbered. Warwick and March were moving towards him like a rat up a drain. They'd soon be on him before he'd managed to recruit many extra soldiers. It's difficult to know how many were involved in the forthcoming battle. The contemporaries claim 60,000 Yorkists and 30,000 Lancastrians. So the only thing we can be confident about is that there was nothing like 60,000 Yorkists and 30,000 Lancastrians. It could be something like 10,000 Yorkists, 5,000 Lancastrians. But the point to cling on to is that the Lancastrians were heavily outnumbered. Never mind, Buckingham was nothing daunted, because he did have the time for him and Grey to set up a defensive position. Some impressive earthworks, shielded by the river, and including cannon to mow down those nasty Yorkists. Meanwhile, Warwick headed north with all speed. He seems to have been joined by the Duke of Norfolk, which was something of a shock for so careful a man as Norfolk. And he was also accompanied by a cloud of churchmen. Warwick was helped by the fact also that he had with him a papal legate, a rather daft little bloke called Coppini, and by the fact that the Archbishop of Canterbury was a Bourchier and loyal to York, and by the fact that Warwick's brother, George Neville, was the Bishop of Exeter. Behind his earthworks with the king, Buckingham received a letter from York. The normal stuff. We love the king, we're really loyal, just want to talk to him, so on and so forth. This time, Buckingham was having none of it. He'd been patient over the years, he'd tried to get people together, but in the end it was his king, right or wrong, and the time for talking was over. He sent a message back to Warwick. The Earl of Warwick shall not come to the king's presence, and if he comes, he shall die. Which seems clear enough. Fine. Not to be outdone, Warwick's herald cantered up to the earthworks and gave his message in return. At 2 o'clock I will speak with the king, or I will die. That was the way Warwick liked it. He didn't want to live forever. The rain was beating down. The Yorkist host was ready to advance. On the right was Lord Fauconberg. In the centre, Warwick. On the left was young Edward, Earl of March, strong and bold and tall. Ahead of them was the ditch, muddy, filled with water from the diverted River Neen, topped by the embankment and guns. March ordered his men forward. It was going to be a tough fight. March was facing the men of Grey of Ruthin, but as they started to climb the embankment, expecting to pay dearly with blood. In fact, they found welcoming hands hauling them up. Soldiers eagerly urging March and his men to hurry, because Grey had decided to defect to the Yorkist side. It's not clear why Grey turned traitor, though the clever money is on something to do with Grey's land dispute with the Duke of Exeter. Equally indeed, it's not clear whether March or Warwick knew before the battle that Grey was planning to defect. But Grey's defection turned a reasonably finely balanced contest into a rout. Before you could say, Grey's done what? Buckingham and his men in the centre had a horde of Yorkists coming at them with sharp bills and grumpy faces. Once again, the cry went up from Warwick to spare the commons and kill the lords. The Lancastrian army collapsed. Some ran for it, others surrendered, yet more died. The River Neen was choked with dead and struggling bodies. In fact, only 300 men lay dead at the end of the battle, which was relatively low. And probably this was largely because the Battle of Northampton, July 1460, lasted only 30 minutes as a competitive contest. But among those 300 were important Lancastrian lords, Egremont, Beaumont and Shrewsbury. And among the dead was the Queen's right hand, Buckingham. They'd fought to the last, defending Henry, sitting in his tent, helpless, and now a prisoner of the Earl of Warwick. The wheel of fortune had turned once more. The Yorkists were on top again. Hearing the news of the defeat, Queen Margaret fled with her son. Now it was her turn to ride furiously down muddy lanes. On the way, her own servants robbed her and deserted her. But she picked herself up. She rode pillion behind a 14-year-old boy, and eventually she reached the relative safety of Harlech, the Edwardian castle on the west coast of Wales. And here Jasper Tudor, the king's half-brother, lived, and as Margaret rode into the castle he noted with horror that such a grand person as a queen should be left with only four servants. The rest of the Lancastrian cause seemed to collapse all at the same time as well. In Guine, the Duke of Somerset decided all his attempts to take Calais were now doomed. He came to terms with Warwick, gave up the castle of Guine, and fled to France for the protection of Charles, the French king. York was still in Ireland, and the news would have taken some time to reach him, but preparations were soon being made for his arrival back in England. By September 1460, Warwick had essentially formed a government around the king. And guess what? Bourchier was back as treasurer. Salisbury was to run the council, and Warwick's brother George Neville became chancellor. Parliament was assembled, and Warwick waited for York to arrive to take his place on the council as protector. Warwick, as it happens, was in for a nasty surprise. York landed near Chester on the 8th of September. A keen observer might have guessed that something was up. He'd gone very grand. He'd gone very grand indeed. He met with his wife, Cecily, newly released from the self-satisfied and patronising captivity of her sister and Buckingham, in Abingdon, which is on the Thames, in Oxfordshire. It's nice that York wanted to see his wife as quickly as he could, and wanted to end at London together. But he was worryingly concerned about how she looked. She was ordered to meet him on a chair covered with blue velvet and drawn by four coursers, a reasonably grand category of horse. From Abingdon, they made a good deal more than the usual fuss and bother as they went to London. There were trumpets and clarions going before them, and very pompously, York ordered his sword to be borne before him, reminiscent of the king and queen and their entrance into Coventry. Oddly, York seems to have stopped using Henry's regnal year to date the documents he wrote at about this time. What, I hear you ask, what was going on? You might well ask, gentle listener, and with just a little more patience, all will be revealed. On Friday the 10th of October, Parliament was once more assembled in the Palace of Westminster in the Painted Chamber. The assembled lords, minus any of the main Lancastrian magnates, it has to be said, were standing talking around an empty throne. Henry was in the Queen's chambers, as it happens, no doubt alone and confused. Warwick was not present, but Salisbury was. Now I'm going to let a contemporary chronicler take up the story, straight from the horse's mouth, as it were. The Duke of York, with the pomp of a great following, arrived in no small exaltation of spirit, for he came with horns and trumpets, and men-at-arms, and very many other servants. And entering the palace there, he marched straight through the great hall until he came to that solemn room where the king was accustomed to hold parliament with his commons. And when he arrived there, he advanced with determined step until he reached the royal throne, and there he laid his hand on the cushion, like a man about to take possession of his right, and kept his hand there for a short while. At last, drawing it back, he turned his face towards the people, and standing still under the cloth of state, he looked attentively at the gazing assembly. "Well, I never did," as my grandmother would have said. Richard of York was claiming the throne. I suspect that the impact of this at the time is a bit difficult for us to understand at this distance and with 2020 hindsight. A bit difficult to understand quite how earth-shattering this new approach was to the lords standing there and the people of England. The king was sacrosanct, anointed by God. Constantly, York and his cronies had profusely claimed that they only wanted to rid the king of his evil counsellors and help the king provide good governance. But this now, this was treason. Richard stood by the throne, gazing at the lords in the painted chamber. In his own mind, all of this was probably very nice and very clear. This incompetent leadership could not go on, and Henry was clearly a total loser, totally incapable of ruling properly. Peace between the factions was quite impossible with the Queen and her son around, since the Queen had consistently demonstrated her refusal to accept York. And this latest round was going to put the cherry neatly on the top of Margaret's implacable hatred. And whether he wanted to or not, he couldn't take a queen and her son down a dark alley and casually cut their throats. So, king, queen, son, they all had to be taken out of the picture without violence. To Richard's mind, the solution was completely, glaringly, right between the eyes, obvious. Here he was, of royal blood, and with a great claim to the throne. Competent, experienced, and to his own mind, devilishly good-looking. He assumed everyone else would be thinking the same thing. So as he stood looking at the lords, he clearly expected enthusiastic applause to come right back at him. What he actually got coming back to him was astonished and horrified silence. An uncomfortable moment when maybe, just maybe, alarm bells started going off in the back of York's mind. But he was committed now. The Archbishop, trying to cover the awkwardness, came up and asked whether he wished to come and see the Lord King. This was not what York wanted to hear. Didn't the Archbishop, his friend, Thomas Bourchier, didn't he realise that he, York, should be king, not this blithering idiot Henry? Why was everyone not cheering with relief? Come on! Infuriated with Bourchier's and everyone else's thickness, York haughtily said, "I know of no person in this realm whom it does not behove to come to me and see my person, rather than that I should go and visit him." The Archbishop retired in confusion, rushed to the Queen's apartments to tell the King what had happened. York, spotting that applause wasn't going to be forthcoming, swept from the hall to the King's royal apartments, smashing the doors open, settling down and making himself comfortable in the manner of a king rather than a duke. The chamber probably erupted into a chaos of noise and chatter once he'd gone. Salisbury legged it straight out of there and along to see Warwick to tell him exactly what had happened. Warwick and Salisbury were appalled. They'd had no idea this was going to happen. This was not part of the plan. They at least could see what York clearly couldn't. Just how much damage this high-handed, arrogant and clumsy action had caused the cause of the House of York. All around London the news spread and indignation grew. York had overstepped the mark. The king was blessed by God. Edward of Coventry was heir. Okay, there were rumours that Edward was the product of Somerset and the Queen, but these were just rumours. Hate it or loathe it, the king was king by right, and that's all there is to it. There is some controversy, everyone, about the way I'm telling the story that I should be upfront about. There is another line of thought, which goes that Warwick was well aware of York's plan, that when he'd visited him in Ireland, that's what they'd discussed. That this was just how Warwick had chosen to play it, to put himself in the best light. At the moment, it's one of those unknowables. For my part, I find it difficult to believe that the fiction would have been maintained for so long, and with all those continuing announcements about loyalty to the king. But who knows? Warwick then had a stormy meeting with the York family. Richard, Edward Earl of March, and Edmund Earl of Rutland. There was quite a bit of grumpiness from Warwick to York. Quite a lot of haughty indifference and obstinance from York to Warwick. Condescension and patronising from the young Edmund, and conciliation and nicey-nicey from March. However, it was Warwick that now sat in the middle. Of Parliament, the Archbishop of Canterbury, York, and Henry. Just like a kingmaker. And in the end, a deal was thrashed out. A deal remarkable enough, to be honest. Very few people wanted to remove a king. Seriously, without precedent, first time it's been mentioned, no one was ready. On the other hand, York was sitting in the Palace of Westminster and behaving like a king already, and there was no one capable of removing him. And it was difficult to deny that Henry was a blithering idiot, and while there were no flies on the Queen, she was hardly going to win the Nobel Peace Prize, even if that had been invented. So, the deal was this. Henry was king, had been crowned, anointed and blessed, and was going to remain king. But when he finally croaked, it would be Richard of York and his heirs that would succeed, not Prince Edward. It was enough to keep York from Henry's throat while retaining constitutional niceties. All of this was confirmed by a ceremony, with Henry tripping along as king, with the Earl of March holding his train, and York moodily walking alone at the back. He wasn't happy with it. He wanted to be king now. So let us leave it there for the moment. I might mention at this point that if anyone thought Margaret of Anjou was going to say, "Oh, okay, fine, good solution, no problem," then we need to know what colour the sky was in their world. But more of that next week. For the moment, I have a bunch of donators to thank this time round, given the Christmas season and so on. So my very grateful thanks to Roy, Mariah, Madeline, Justin, Elise, Ailing, Bob, Michael, Murray, Al, William and John. And then to four super generous donators, David, Michael, Ralph and Robert. Thank you so much. And then to my beloved monthly donators, Richard, Kathy, Jim, Jubal, Matthew, Nancy, Cool, Matthew, Brad, William and Dan. Thanks a million. And thanks to everyone who's commented on the website, Facebook, iTunes and all that sort of thing. And to all of you who listen in. Good luck, everyone, and have a great week.